the third said.
I'll just assume it's going to the guys flying the planes that dropped all that there napalm.
By that time, MCB had pretty much taken over. They'd relieved the drillers and firemen, along with an admonition not to talk. We gave all of them a huge bonus. Military guys who knew their way around a drill rig and fire pumps took over. Gordon and his surviving people left happily. We'd been told that even with the Mava dead, all the goop would have to be pumped out and rendered, that is, mixed with holy water to remove the evil before it got dumped. That was left up to the local priests because Father Madruga and his entourage had disappeared without even saying goodbye. Madam Courtney and her people performed a big ceremony after the MCB bulldozed the warehouse. It was supposed to remove any curses and drive off any lingering evil spirits. Plus, she promised that it would increase the property's resale value. She told me that the Loas said now the circle was complete. Alpha and Omega. What one brother had caused, the other had fixed. A curse had been broken. I stuck around long enough to watch the last of the Kifo worm mush get scraped up and dumped in an incinerator, then gratefully packed up and went home. I was looking forward to the hot tub.
Is Sir in?
Remy asked. Sir was definitely in lately. In the 6 weeks since the Mava bit the dust, there had been no more than the occasional supernatural event. Outbreaks were down across the whole region. If we hadn't just made the biggest bank in puff history on the Mava and the rest of the battle, MHI would be looking at a very bad quarter, and so would I. As it was, I was actually in the hot tub, alone for the first time in days, perusing tropical islands. I was thinking of buying one. The real cost wasn't the island. It was the upkeep. I had that covered as well. The puff on a larval old one was so record-setting that Treasury was having to pay us in installments. The puff was so high that even though we had spent millions of dollars on construction, armament, Ray the Fourth alone had fired over 50 laws and RPGs during the battle, and subcontractors, Al Gordon's team could all retire as millionaires, and I think Neil Franson used his consulting fee to buy most of Yellowknife, there was still a huge profit left over. I was given primary status since I was the one who'd tracked down the Mava and gotten most of the plan into place. I could afford an island. It appeared my political problems were a thing of the past. Committee members were returning my calls again. The new interim MCB director wasn't being an asshole. I was so popular with the committee, I could probably have sex with a fae on the Capitol steps and get away with it. Not that I'd ever stick my dick in one of those. There were tentacles and stuff. Is it work? I asked.
It is, Remy said. They vouchsafe that there is...
You'd think with this town settled down that we'd be done with Sobek, I said, looking through the scope at the 50-foot bipedal crocodilian. I had him square in my sights, but I hesitated. Mr. Johnson?
What are you waiting for?
The army engineer asked, furious. Any way you can think of to let it over the pumping station that won't damage things?
You nuts, Sam Haven said. You saw what that thing did the last time. I like Honey Bear and all, but I really don't want to have another low-speed super alligator chase across the city again.
Crocodile, I corrected Sam as I got up from out of the prone. Look, these things magically appear every so often. I'm tired of them. I thought it must have something to do with the Mava and they'd just go away, but obviously not. They always follow the same path. We'll get a helo and track it. If it gets out of the canal and threatens anything, I'll pop it. But I want to know where the damn thing is going. Maybe then we can get them to stop. We had to get a crane while the thing continued to do damage to the levee. But Mr. Johnston agreed with the basic logic, and we got it done. Once down in the canal, it stayed there. We'd arranged to core Huey instead of borrowing Mr. Aristide Lambert's Jet Ranger, and we trailed it down the canal. It passed the Metairie Bridge without incident, and just continued down the canal. We'd arranged for SIU to block roads, but people were coming out to watch the 50-foot crocodile walk down the canal, and it just kept going. It wasn't bothering anyone if it wasn't bothered. People were taking pictures. It was New Orleans. MCB would just do a story in the Truth Teller and some badly retouched photos in the Weekly World News, and it would just be another impossible story out of New Orleans, like the flying saucer that caused a zombie outbreak until it was destroyed by a meteor that was probably thrown by another alien race it was fighting. Possible alien fugitives were possibly on the loose in the New Orleans area, and people should be careful around cemeteries until they were all tracked down. Aliens were the MCB's answer to everything now. Then again, Faye. The Sobek wandered down past the New Orleans Country Club, where golfers were gathering at the fence, to watch it pass. Palmetto Street started paralleling the canal around there, and you could tell the locals from the out-of-towners. The not-locals were taking one look and then driving away as fast as they could. The locals were getting out and watching. I saw one guy who must have been out grocery shopping toss a big chunk of meat to it. The Sobek caught it in midair and seemed to nod as if to say, "Thanks for the snack." New Orleans. New York had Broadway. New Orleans had street theater, and there wasn't much better street theater than a 50-foot crocodile. I was waiting for the second line to start. It continued south, crawling under bridges and under Airline Highway. I think some not-locals spotted it off the highway, but it wasn't bothering anyone. MCB's problem. There were news choppers up by that time following it. They'd never be able to release the tape, but they were, by God, going to get that shot. There was an FBI chopper up in New Orleans Parish. All of them were staying well back from us. MHI had this. They had to be wondering when we were going to take the shot, but would wonders never cease? They weren't interfering. Just past Airline Highway, it started looking like it was trying to find a way out. It kept scrabbling at the sides to the northeast. There was a small building and an open area that looked like a ball field. The building looked like a school or a daycare or something. Fortunately, there weren't any kids on the playground. "Call SIU," I said over the intercom. "Tell them to get a car down there and make damn sure all those kids are inside. If it threatens the school, I'll take it, but I want to see where the damn thing is going."
"If it gets out, it could get up to the highway," Sam pointed out.
"I'll stop it if it does. Open up the doors." The Huey had sliding doors. I mounted the Barrett and leaned in, following the croc in my scope. This would be easier than shooting frogs off the Superdome. "Pilot, I need to be about 100 feet lower for the right angle," I said over the intercom. "We really need to be that close?" the pilot asked. He clearly wasn't happy being in the same state. "You can back up from it, but I need a 27-degree entry angle on its head."
"Got it," the pilot said. "Can somebody check port to see if I'm running into anything?"
"Got it," Sam called. "Clear port and back on port."
"Clear starboard back,"
I said, looking over. I didn't want to hit a power line. I tuned out the calls as the Sobek, convinced it couldn't get out by the highway, headed further down the canal. SIU and state troopers had closed Palmetto for a couple blocks down and were holding back traffic in the area. No innocents were in sight of the croc. It finally managed to scramble out at the corner of the field where Monroe Street terminated at Palmetto. It made its way across Palmetto, which was elevated, down onto Monroe. Monroe was closed for a couple of blocks back, but I wasn't going to let it get far. There was a major highway in threat, the school or whatever, houses. I wasn't going to let this one go on a rampage like the other. The croc instead headed into the field, stopped, dropped onto its belly, and started digging. It dug for about 15 minutes as we watched, pulling up the dirt with its stubby forelimbs and tossing it back with its back limbs. It finally got to whatever it was looking for and stood up. It had what looked exactly like a pirate chest clutched in its claws. Then it vanished. One second, there was a 50-foot-tall bipedal crocodilian standing by a hole in the ground. The next moment, there was a hole in the ground and some big-ass paw prints. We never did figure out what the hell was in the chest. I've searched every record I could find. The closest I ever came to it was a vague reference to Jean Lafitte's treasure and something he'd found that he'd hidden because of the hoodoo. But that was the last time a Sobek was ever seen in New Orleans. I missed another big puff bounty, but it's not about the puff. It's about keeping people safe. New Orleans was never threatened by another Sobek, and I call that a win. Epilogue. About a month later, Sam Haven and I got called to Cazador. I was ready to go. New Orleans is a great town when you're hunting monsters, even if not. The aura of Hoodoo Squad was still on, probably more since we'd apparently ended the true danger of hoodoo. We were treated like kings. Plenty of fish in the New Orleans Sea, and they practically jumped in your boat. The food was good, but it was also hot, steamy hot, and I was getting as bored as I'd been at Sandals. There was less activity than Seattle in my day. Maybe a minor call out once a week. It was a far cry from our wild, non-stop, full-moon monster fest. Oh, there are still monsters in New Orleans. Don't let your guard down. But the ones that remain are far more interested in keeping their heads down. Ray wouldn't say why the call, but I had my own sources. Eastern Europe was heating up. Bad. An entire town had been wiped out by what amounted to a lycanthrope army.
"We're forming a team to head to Eastern Europe," Boss Shackelford told us, looking around the conference room. I knew all the people in it. Sam Haven, former SEAL and all-around badass. Milo Anderson, hippie, goofy, vicious monster killer. Susan Shackelford, the baddest bitch in the valley, now freed enough from mommy duties to go earn some of that delicious puff money again. Raymond Shackelford IV, brilliant scion of a monster-hunting family. Earl Harbinger, the meanest and unquestionably toughest monster killer in the business. And then there was me, Iron Hand, the top puff recipient in recent history before I was instrumental in killing an old one.
"The place is getting overrun with vamps and werewolves and every other kind of boggle. NATO's formed a new group, the Organization for Supernatural Security Cooperation in Europe. U.S. Western Country puff bonuses, and it's a virgin playing field."
Some of those Eastern European girls had been turning up in the strip clubs in New Orleans. If they all looked pretty much the same, I was on this like stink on a mava.
"Who's up for it?"
"Cowboy up,"
Sam said.
"Kill monsters?" Milo chimed in. "Get paid," Susan said.
"It's get laid, Susan," I said.
"Get laid."
Milo just shook his head while the rest of the group laughed. We were MHI's top hunters. The monsters had better run at our very names. Eastern Europe was never going to be the same. And neither was Monster Hunter International. Because we weren't all coming home. Afterword by Earl Harbinger.
Chad started to talk about our mission to Eastern Europe, but there was no sign of that record anywhere in the archives. I don't think he ever got the chance to write it. That was the job where we lost Susan, and everything changed. Her disappearance pushed Ray down a dark path. that eventually ended in an event that ruined our company and cost 97 hunters their lives, including Oliver Chadwick Gardenier, the Iron Hand. Rest in peace, you magnificent bastard. Milo brought these memoirs to me, saying I'd be the best one to finish the story. I'm not sure that's the case. Me and Chad didn't always see eye to eye. But Milo is a persistent one, and when he gets an idea in his head, he doesn't ever let up. Milo was just a kid back in those days, and he still thinks of Chad like an older brother. If I didn't write this, Milo would bug me for the rest of his life, which would be short. So here goes. When I first met Chad Gardenier, he struck me as one of those know-it-alls who I figured would wash out of training. Sure, he was talented, smart, and a hard worker, but there are plenty of tough guys and smart guys who get killed in this business because they don't have the sense when to shut up and listen. Why would they need to? They were born knowing everything. Chad had that too-clever-for-his-own-good trait in spades. If we don't catch those in time and get them straightened out or weeded out, the question isn't whether they'll get messed up or killed out in the world, but rather how many members of their team will get hurt in the process. I wasn't much impressed to start. My background is straightforward, country, get shit done, and don't put on airs about it. Chad was too damn frou-frou for me. He was always dressing up, tailored everything. These were the 80s. It was all about flash. He barely even mentioned things like the fancy dinner parties he'd hold at his place in New Orleans. I'm a beer and steak kind of guy. Chad was caviar, raw fish, and then arguing over the quality of the wine list with a sommelier for 30 minutes. I don't even know if he liked wine or if he just wanted everybody else at dinner to be impressed how much he knew about it. But I'm getting ahead of myself. First impressions. He didn't strike me as a man who could go the distance. As much as Chad despised his parents, he'd grown up with snooty academics, so when given any opportunity to try and show off how smart he was, he'd take it. Boy couldn't help himself. He was that way from his newbie class, and it never really changed his entire career. Hell, on the night he died, he was still lecturing party guests about some esoteric something or other so everyone would know how clever he was, like how he was the only guy in the world who had ever learned Yeti sign language or some shit. Yet, he'd been a Marine, and that inclined me to like him. We've hired a ton over the years. They tend to do pretty damn good as hunters. He worked hard, and gotta give him credit. The boy had a mind like a steel trap. In those days, he was one of our sharpest. When it came to the supernatural, probably as tuned in as Ray the Fourth or Marty Hood. I suppose it says a lot about Chad's actual character, about how he turned out in comparison to either of them. Seattle. I hoped working for the Nelsons would help temper him. Maybe even teach him some wisdom and humility to go with those smarts. But instead, he ended up almost getting our company in a war with the fucking Yakuza of all things, and then made a bargain with a fake court. Every time I got a report, I was either tempted to fire his ass or impressed that he'd pulled off some crazy stunt, and sometimes both simultaneously. The Nelsons loved him like a son. Still do to this day. Those two can't help but psychoanalyze everybody they meet. To them, Chad was a product of his environment. A genius overachiever raised by an evil mother, a dirtbag father, and an abusive brother who hid his smarts out of spite. Once he was free of them and able to do what he wanted, of course he desired recognition from his peers. The Nelsons like to say all of us are the sum of our experiences. I once asked the Nelsons how to fix him. They said there was no fixing people. There was just providing some guidance when possible, hoping for the best, and enjoying the adventure. It's not the kind of employee evaluation that fills a leader with joy. There's usually a fine line between cocky and confident. Chad didn't have a line. Only it ain't bragging if you can do it on demand. He got the job done. He always got the job done. Then New Orleans. I tell you, Hoodoo Squad saw some shit. They had more action in less time than just about any other team in MHI's history. Pipe hitters and party animals. Those boys did work. I hated New Orleans. I despised that town. It's pretty quiet now, thanks to the sacrifices of Hoodoo Squad. But for several years back in the 80s, it was a constant thorn in our side. Anything that could go wrong, did. I knew Chad blamed me for what happened to his team on Mardi Gras. He hated my guts for it. That's okay. Sometimes a man just needs someone to blame so he can get back to work. Yet again, through all that blood and chaos, Chad still got the job done. As many of you are aware, a couple years ago I got into a fight with the demon Rakhasnarath, Devourer of Souls, Reaper of Worlds, and a bunch of other self-appointed titles that asshole wouldn't shut up about. Many of my memories were damaged or lost. I'm still trying to put some things back together. That said, I've still got enough left to know that Chad's versions of events sometimes diverge significantly from the way I remember them happening. But the whole bit about being blown to hell in Beirut and being sent back to life, supposedly by St. Peter, until he could fulfill some important mission from God? I didn't buy that the first time I heard it from him. Believe me, for the kind of men who end up in this line of work, that sort of belief ain't particularly odd. There's plenty of tough sons of bitches who think they're destined for something great until life busts them in the chops and they either die badly or get over their foolish notions. Except I saw how Chad went out. So I believe it now. You chose the right man for the job, Pete. The Eastern European mission he started writing about at the end was a hard one. The thing about monster hunting, sometimes you do everything right and people still die, while other times you do everything wrong, get lucky, and live. That time we did everything right. I put together the best team. We worked hard. We fought smart. We picked fights we could win and avoided the ones where we were at a disadvantage. We still got the rug pulled out from under us, and it ruined everything. By that time, I can't say that I liked Chad, but I trusted him with my life. He still rubbed me the wrong way, yet I knew he was one of the best hunters I had. The man could solve problems, and he could fight. He also could annoy the hell out of me and cause more trouble than he was worth. Between him and Sam picking up on half the female population of every town and village we rolled through, or him and Milo annoying me with some crazy scheme, or him and Ray rocking the political boat, agitating to get a communist dictator overthrown, I can't say if he made my life easier or harder. I've never written about how we lost Susan. I don't really want to. Someday, maybe. Chad didn't get to it here, and I'm a little glad for that. In brief, we got outplayed. It wasn't until years later that I learned just how badly we'd been tricked back then. At the end of a battle, part of our team had broken off to chase down a weak and wounded vampire. I'd been with Sam and Milo. The pursuit had been Ray, Susan, and Chad's call. Only they ended up blowing up a castle, and Susan disappeared in the chaos. It was like she'd vanished. We searched the wreckage for days, and after we'd given up hope that she was alive, we dragged the river and explored miles of forest and catacombs. We searched for weeks and came up with nothing. Even I couldn't find her. And I'm decent at tracking. The logical assumption was that her body had been eaten by one of the ghoul packs that infested the area. Those things consume bodies so thorough that it's like they're scrubbed from the face of the earth, bones and all, leaving not a trace. I'd never seen a man break as hard as Ray did then. We weren't finished there, but Ray was. He sank into a place so black that eventually it nearly doomed us all. We had all loved Susan. and I know that Chad held himself to blame. He was never quite the same after that. But he still got the rest of that job done. That's kind of the thing about Iron Hand. Some of us loved him, and some of us hated him. But when you needed a puzzle figured out, or you really needed something killed, he was the man to point at it. Which was why the night of the Christmas party, when it was do or die, just one chance to get it right, and I had to send somebody to do something that meant almost certain death, I picked Chad. After Europe, most of us got back to work. Chad went up to the New York team. Manhattan in the 90s had a lot of monster activity. Part of that big crime cleanup was actually the city instituting some new hunter-friendly policies that allowed us to be a little more proactive. He was one of my best troubleshooters. And trouble causers. It usually worked out. It went pretty much how you expected. Manhattan had all that fancy culture Chad prided himself on appreciating, plenty of snooty politicians and professors to wow, and about a million single ladies. Chad got a penthouse and decorated it like he was a Japanese Hugh Hefner. He dragged along his poor butler Remy, too. Now that there was a dignified fellow. I don't know how he put up with it. One day, Remy told me Chad went from having a different woman on his arm for every event to just the same one over and over. Apparently he'd finally found a woman he couldn't drive off. Well, stranger things have happened. Chad damaged his sword in New York. The man was distraught. I didn't get it. I never understood any of that mystical Bushido nonsense. I appreciate quality weapons as much as the next hunter. But when I buy knives, I always order some spares because you're going to lose or break them. They're just steel tools. Not for him. Chad was all into that soul of the sword mystique, and he'd talk your ear off about it. I think the idea of having to retire Mono Ken hit him like the death of a teammate. The last time I talked to Chad on the phone was to give him what I thought at the time was good news. Ray went nuts when Susan died. Simple as that. All his friends had been worried about him ever since, Milo especially. I know Chad had visited a few times over the intervening years, trying to get through to Ray, to bring him out of his funk. He'd always left frustrated. But the reason I called was to tell Chad that it looked like Ray was finally shaking off his depression. Chad had been on that mission. He deserved the update. Ray was getting out, even working again. He even wanted to put together something big to celebrate the company's 100th birthday. I thought it sounded like a waste of time, but everybody else thought it was a great idea, especially Ray and Susan's kids. It was going to be the biggest celebration in company history, I told him. Everybody was invited. I figured Chad would appreciate it because this sort of thing was right up his alley. MHI was going to throw a Christmas party. Everybody had a real nice time, up until when the killing started. I had spent a lot of money. Big crowd. Hunters brought spouses and dates. All our retirees had been invited, too. We rented this resort place on the Gulf that Ray had picked out. He told me that him and Susan had visited there, and it'd been real nice. He lied right to my face, and I didn't know any better. He'd never been there. He wanted that spot because it was on sacred land, a conflux of power, something that a crazy person would pick out as the ideal spot for a ritual. Even the band knew who they were playing for, what we did for a living, and the kinds of things we did it to. The caterers and bartenders were all people who were in the know. They brought in food and booze by the truckload. This was when MHI was at its largest, so even with all the hunters busy working a job, we still had a few hundred people show up. Lots of old friends reunited, buddies who'd fought together, experienced folks who hadn't seen each other since training, and a bunch of newbies trying to fit in and sound tough. I knew them all. And thinking about the ones we lost there still hurts. But this memoir is about one in particular. Obviously, Chad arrived fashionably late, in a tux, with what I first thought was a supermodel on his arm, and I shit you not, wearing his fucking samurai sword. I suppose it was his fashion accessory and conversation starter. Why the hell not? It was a monster hunter party. Have fun. I made some polite conversation with Chad. Small talk, I guess they'd call it. We still weren't what anyone would call friends. But when I got close, I got a better take on his girlfriend. The nose knows. Me and her needed to have a word, so I gave her a knowing look and then went to have a smoke. A minute later, she excused herself, ditched her boyfriend, and came outside to talk with me alone. Even the parking lot had a good view of the ocean. I'm kind of surprised seeing one of your kind show your pretty face here, I told her.
I've earned my puff exemption.
You got your tag on you?
I'll show you mine if you show me yours.
Lady, there's a couple hundred hunters here who'd cap you for the bounty, then go back to drinking without a second thought.
They could try, but it wouldn't be necessary.
Then she showed me her silver puff exemption tag. From the number etched on it, I'd guess the issue date would have been around 1945 or so.
I did my time.
Does Chad know what you really are?
No. I'd rather keep it that way. I love him.
I was starting to like this one. Just don't break his heart.
I don't think any woman could.
We both know you ain't no ordinary woman. The party went on for hours, everybody having a good old time. Many of you know this story. A few of you who read this were probably there. There was a commotion on the dance floor. I was across the hall, but I saw that it was Ray, up to something. When I heard him speak, it was so loud that my first thought was that he'd gotten a microphone and maybe he was going to make an announcement or something. Only he was staggering around, unnatural, and the words weren't right. He was speaking some weird language. In these memoirs, when Chad writes about all those languages he knew, that was no bullshit. He really had the gift of tongues. When Ray started speaking, I saw Chad leap up and look in that direction with a look on his face like, "What the hell did you say?" That's probably because he was the only man there who recognized the ancient words.
"Somebody stop him!"
But by the time Chad shouted that, it was too late. Later on, we found out the spell was supposed to bring Susan back from the dead. I don't know what Ray thought would happen. Like after he made a blood-packed circle in the middle of a dance floor in front of the whole company, she'd rise up through it like some glowing angel and everybody would cheer. Except poor delusional Ray had been conned, suckered by a necromancer who'd been playing the long game. That wasn't what that spell did at all. The circle beneath Ray's feet vanished, and he dropped right through into nothing. There was a crack of thunder and a rush of air. The closest people on the dance floor got swept off their feet. And then, it was like thousands of claws clicking, and monsters came pouring out of the hole. It was so fast, and there were so many, the dance floor erupted like a volcano. Only instead of lava, bodies. We fought these things a couple times since, but this was our first encounter. They're sort of man-shaped, but mostly bug-like, with shells like crabs, claws, and teeth that can shred a man to the bone in a flash. They're colorful bastards, bright orange and red, purples, too many eyes, too many joints. All so damned alien that the sight of them shakes even the hardest hunter in battle. And a horde of them came swarming out. This was sudden violence. We weren't ready to fight. Nobody was geared up. Most of us were drunk, and then Out of nowhere, we were waist-deep in unexpected, razor-sharp insect monsters tearing us to pieces. It only took a heartbeat or two, but God bless MHI, we reacted. Guns came out. Tables were flipped for cover. Wounded and innocents were dragged out of the way. And my people went to town. The hole just kept pumping out monsters like a chest wound leaking blood. I was killing things and shouting orders in between. Hunters ran for their cars and came back with heavier weapons. Those barely made a dent. All around, our people were dying. Of all the memories that son of a bitch Rocky could rip from my mind, oh, why did he have to leave this one so perfectly clear? Before I say something about how Chad died, there's one brief shining moment that shows exactly how that man lived. Ray the Younger got ripped limb from limb. His sister Julie, just a young woman then, she jumped in swinging a table leg, clubbing down monsters, refusing to abandon her dead brother's side, screaming like a berserker. The Shackelford kids had turned out to support their dad, and he'd condemned them to hell. Julie was surrounded. She was going to die, and I couldn't get there in time. But thank God, Iron Hand did. When the Shackelfords were little, they'd taken a liking to him, and he was so protective of them they had even called him Uncle Chad. Well, he earned that title that night. He'd already run his pistol dry. Most of us had by then. But he'd pulled out that damaged sword and gone in swinging, throwing himself right into the middle of the demons and hacking through shells and into arms and legs. He shoved Julie away from her brother and steered her out of there, cutting down monsters the whole way. To this day, I've never really talked to Julie much about that night. I don't know if she even knows it was Uncle Chad who saved her life. By a miracle, we got organized. We held that ground, that dance floor turned into a killing field. We established choke points, locked down the halls, and then had to deal with monsters clawing their way through the floors and ceiling. I can't say how we knew, instinct maybe, just being human in the face of something so not. But however we got it, all of us had the understanding that there was no retreat. It was hold now, or lose forever. We found out why when something pushed against the rift. The floor lifted like a bubble. A different reality mingled with our own. I can't really explain what it was we saw through that hole. The thing beneath New Orleans had been one of their babies. This was a father. Of those of us who lived, some who saw through to the other side quit. Couple went crazy and wound up at Appleton. Yet that thing, that god-awful, cursed thing, unless we did something, it was coming through. Only for a brief instant across a room full of demons, I saw that Ray Shackelford was still inside the rift. Ray was the key. He'd started this. My only hope was that pulling him out would end it. Many of you know the story that I somehow made it into the gate and into the other dimension. Grabbed Ray, dragged him out, and that closed it. This is about the somehow. Problem being, I couldn't get through. There was just too much distance and too many demons between us. I needed to get to the other side before it was too late. I needed somebody to punch through, to create a gap I could use. But looking at that wall of claws and spines, whoever I sent was as good as dead. I spotted Chad holding back monsters with a bent sword. His girlfriend was hiding behind him, wounded, with a spine piercing her side. But she'd be fine. It's tough to put down her kind. I walked up and said, "Iron Hand, make me a hole." He understood. When hell had come to town, when there wasn't anyone else we could depend upon. I knew he was the one person who could and would make that hole. Without fear. Without hesitation. Even Milo or Sam might have hesitated. Not Iron Hand. With that damaged katana, he stopped trying to hold the line, and like the Marine he was to the core, he charged the enemy. He knew he was going to die. Horribly. Painfully. He didn't let that worry him. He laid into those demons like there was no tomorrow, hacking them down faster than they could kill him. He got cut, stabbed, bit, but he just kept going. I'm wondering now at the end, with the blood loss and the poison and the pain, during that, did he realize and know that this is what he had been sent back to the world of the living for? It was his perfect warrior moment. Maybe there was something to all that soul-of-the-sword stuff of his after all. Chad kept cutting and moving. It was just the two of us in a sea of monsters. I followed in his wake, smashing down anything that got close until the portal was near enough for me to make my move. We had to climb over piles of corpses. A claw ripped out one of Chad's eyes. Another sliced through his abdomen and spilled his guts. But Chad still kept fighting. He was covered in blood, human red and demonic orange. He lost a hand, but kept using his sword with the other. Then Mono Ken broke over the head of a demon. In a flash, they were all over him, biting and tearing. And Chad turned to me as the monsters sliced his flesh to ribbons and tore him into pieces, and he smiled, because he was on the way back to his precious Greenlands. So as Chad traveled to one world, I leapt through the gate into another. I will never write of the horrors I saw on the other side. There was still a whole lot of killing to do. While it seemed like an eternity to me there, only a minute or two passed on Earth. When I came out of the hole carrying Ray, the spell was broken. The gate slammed shut behind us. The room returned to normal, except now it was torn apart, covered in bodies, and the resort was burning down around us. If you are reading this, you know the rest. We evacuated. MCB rolled in and dropped the hammer on us. The place burned for days with an unnatural hellfire. But if we hadn't stopped that breach, it would be the whole world burning. One last thing I remember. As I was there on the beach, counting bodies to the rising sun, I noticed the address on the front gate of the resort for the first time. 57 Gulf View. Like I said before, good call, St. Pete. Iron Hand was one of the toughest hunters it has ever been my honor to have known. Oliver Chadwick Gardenier would go in against overwhelming odds, the nastiest, toughest, scariest supernatural creatures on the face of the planet, and rip them a new asshole. Iron Hand died, a hero to the core. And his daughter is pretty badass, too. Earl Harbinger, Monster Hunter International, Cazador, Alabama.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Monster Hunter Memoirs, Saints, written by Larry Correa and John Ringo, performed by Oliver Wyman. Executive producers Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer Chris Sacco. Copyright 2018 by Larry Correa and John Ringo. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.